Okay, so for the second half of the talk, I'll describe in some detail how you build a practical optical trap. What is involved when you do this? So first of all, I want to make a distinction between an optical trap just as a manipulation tool. And there's actually a lot of people in the field that just do this, that, you know, for nanofabrication or for people move cells or organelles, that type of thing. The requirements are different if you actually want to have a quantitative optical trap that actually reads out things like forces and displacements. So first thing is obviously you need the ability to manipulate. So as I mentioned before, the ability to trap is dependent on how intense the light is and how large a gradient you can generate. And you can do the latter by using a good lens, like a high numerical aperture objective, to focus the light down very tightly. You also need to be able to move this relative to a stage or another trap by either having a piezo stage, so you can move one trap. I'll describe that in more detail in the next slide, or by moving the trap itself. And there are different ways of doing that. So that's basically number one. If you need to do anything with a trap, you need to be able to manipulate to apply forces to the object that you're interested in. Number two is you need to be able to measure. So you need to be able to somehow detect how this bead is moving inside your trap and measure that very accurately. And number three is you need to be able to calibrate. So what you're going to measure is probably going to be some voltage out of some photodetector or something like that. And you have to find a way to convert that into an actual physically meaningful measurement, which is your force in piconewtons or your displacements in nanometers. So these three components are essential for building a quantitative optical trap. So here is an example of one of these setups. This is a trap that I built as a postdoc when I was at Berkeley. And when we go down to the lab, it's a very similar setup as this. But essentially, you start off with a laser. You have a beam expander. The reason you have a beam expander is, like I said, your trapping efficiency depends on how much light you put in the marginal rays, so the ones that are at the outer angles. So you basically want to make the beam as large as possible when it fits into your objective, so that you have as much power on the outer rays. Those are the ones, the good ones, that form the gradients. The ones that are in the center are actually going to tend to push the bead away from scattering forces. So you have a beam expander, because most of the beams that come out of lasers are fairly small. So yeah, you build a telescope so that you can expand it fairly large. And then you input this beam into one objective that's going to form the trap into your sample chamber. Number two, you have a condenser. In our setup, it's actually identical to the first objective, but you can just use a regular condenser, and that's basically to collect all the light that came from the trap. And lastly, you're going to image these onto a photodetector. And I'll describe exactly how you do that in the next few slides. Yeah, this is a blow-up of the sample chamber region. And then when we go down to see my lab, you'll see a very similar setup. So this is the objective that forms the trap inside the sample chamber, and this one collects the light and images it onto photodetectors. So in terms of manipulation, obviously you want to be applying forces onto object, which means that you have to hold them at two ends. So for the kinesin measurement, for example, you have one bead that's held, that's attached to the kinesin. The kinesin is on a microtubule that's on a stage. So if you want to stretch this molecule or apply forces to it, then you have to be able to move one of these things relative to the other. So in many of the early assays, what they were doing is moving the stage relative to the trap. And the trap stayed fixed in space. The only thing that they did is move the stage relative to that, so you can stretch your molecule that way. And you can do this with a piezo stage, essentially. Or you can go, and this is more of what I do, you have two traps formed from the same laser. But you can form two traps and then move one trap relative to the other. And you can do this with a lens or a steerable mirror or an acousto-optical deflector. Do people know what an acousto-optical deflector is? Okay. It's not crucial, but yeah, I can describe it. So, okay, obviously with a mirror you can move a trap around, so you can imagine how you could move this beam of light around in a sample cell. And AOD basically is a tunable diffraction grating. So AOD stands for Cousteau-Optic Deflector. So you have a crystal, it's a special crystal that's nonlinear, and a piezo on here that has the property that if you excite this mechanically, you can modulate the index of refraction in this crystal. So if you drive your piezo at some frequency, you can actually set up a standing wave inside this crystal, which modulates the refractive index. What happens when you send a beam of light in here is obviously it's seeing what's it's a diffraction grating. So the zeroth order beam goes through, and the first order beam is diffracted at some angle that depends on the wavelength of this excitation. And of course, this depends on the frequency at which you drive this. So basically, let's say you have a frequency here, you can change this angle as a function of the frequency that you drive your piezo. So it's a tunable diffraction grating that allows you to steer a beam very accurately just by changing the frequency of this piezo. These are very nice optical devices. So if you start looking in the literature and see this used, this is one of the methods that's used to move beams around. Okay, measurement. So we want to measure forces and displacements. And what that entails is measuring the deflection of the bead from the trap center. So remember that the trap is acting like a harmonic trap, and so it's basically the force is linear with the displacement of the bead from the center. So if you measure the displacement of the bead from the center, you can measure forces, and you can also get displacements. Generally, people do this in two different types of ways. One, they can use video microscopy, so they actually take an image of the bead in the trap and see how it's moved around. This is not a very accurate way of doing things. A much more accurate way of doing this is to use laser-based method, and I'm going to discuss one in particular called back focal plane interferometry in the next few slides.
Yeah. Yep. Could you explain again how you can measure forces and displacement?
So I'm going to basically get to that as I go on. So the first step here, I'm just going to describe how you measure a displacement of the bead. And then next, I'll talk about calibration, which is how you just convert that into an actual force or displacement. Okay, so back focal plane interferometry, the basic idea is that this is the wave train of your optical trap, and this is the object that's being trapped. Basically, you can think of this as a point source that's emanating light, and this thing is a focused light beam that's interacting with this. So there's an interference pattern between the light that's scattered off this object and the trapping beam itself. When the two are in the center, then you get an intensity profile that's essentially like a Gaussian here at the back focal plane of your condenser. So basically what happens on the back end of your condenser, you get this intensity profile. But as you move this beam out from the center, then you can see that the phase relationship between the wave train of your trap and your object changes. And so you're going to get constructive interference on one end and destructive interference at the other end. So what that means is that you actually modulate the intensity profile of the light at the objective. Does that kind of make sense? I see some confused looks.
Yeah. One of the beams is the one that you're actually trapping.
That's right.
And the other one is from where the light source is from.
So there's no, yeah. One of them, yeah. So the red one is the trap itself, and the bead also scatters, but it scatters basically symmetrically from the bead itself. So you have light, which is from the trap. It's basically the interference pattern from the trapping light and the trapping light that's scattered off this object. Does that make more sense?
You literally mean that it's scattered, not just the index of refraction.
So it's actually forward scattered, so it could be refracted too. You're right. This is maybe confusing because it's a different way of looking at it than the ray optics that, that I showed earlier. I can show you that there's kind of an easy correspondence between the two. But the point is that there's light that's emanating from this bead in due to the trap, and that light interferes with the trapping light itself. And that generates an interference pattern at the back focal plane of your objective, which is dependent on the position of this bead relative to the trap. Does that make sense? That's basically all you have to know.
Yeah. Can you read this out on either side of the trap plane?
In principle, yes. You could have a photodetector here that looks at the back scattered light, and you get a similar interference pattern. Yeah.
Can you explain what the back focal plane of the objective is?
So if you have a lens, so you know from basic optics that if you come in with parallel rays of light, then those get focused on at a particular plane, right? And I can come in at a different angle, and they're focused at a different point, but on the same plane, okay? This plane is called, so it's called the back focal plane of the objective. If I draw my objective like this, so this is the body of the objective. The back focal plane is the focal plane where parallel rays of light get focused on. And so it's basically inside your objective. Does that make sense?
Do you have access to this plan? I mean, for high numerical objective, usually back focal plane is in between different lenses. You do not have access.
But not only that, it's actually inside the body of the lens itself.
Yes, so, accesses.
Okay, so that's a very good point. So what you can do is, if you have another lens in here, it's basically, it acts as an imaging lens that images this plane onto another plane, which is, in optics, you would call that a conjugate plane. And now, you put your photodetector in here. Obviously, you can't put it inside the body of your objective, so you put it outside. So you use a lens, essentially, as an imaging method to image the back focal plane onto where your photodetector is.
Yeah. And that's a separate lens. It doesn't come.
That's right. It's a separate lens. So when we look at the setup, I can show you exactly what you know what this looks like. Right. So if you want to think of it in a more simplistic way as ray optics, you can think of it as your bead is acting like a lens. You know, I'm sending my trapping light. If this thing is centered at the focus of the trapping light, then the beam profile is centered about the optical axis. If I move it laterally, then I'm moving this pattern laterally. And if I move it axially, so along the optical axis, then I change how big or small this cone of light is. And so especially in this respect, if you image this onto a photodetector, a position-sensitive photodetector, you can get a very accurate reading of how much this object is deflected from the center of the trap. Yeah.
And now what order can you tell deflection?
Okay, so that actually it's in this slide that I'll show you that. This is getting back to your question of this relay lens that images this back focal plane onto a photodetector, a position sensitive photodetector. Now I can give you some numbers. These things are amazingly sensitive. In fact, that's why it's the preferred method for measurement in optical traps, because they are so sensitive, much more than video microscopy. So typically you get about a volt of signal onto your photodetectors for 100 nanometer deflection. This depends on the bead size, the geometry of your setup, of course, but this is kind of a typical number. So if you imagine that your back-end electronics has noise of something like 10 microvolts, which is pretty typical, that corresponds to 0.1 angstrom resolution. So you can do insanely well with this. You can get sub-angstrom resolution of the position of the bead. That's why it's so powerful. It's so much better than anything else you can get. So it really only depends on how noisy your electronics are on your photodetectors to detect these things. Okay. So I actually wanted to show you one of these photodetectors, what they look like. There's two different types of photodetectors that people use in standard optical trap designs. One is called a quadrant photodetector. This is called a dual lateral photodetector, and basically it looks like that. It's just a small object that's about a centimeter squared. And what it consists of is two layers of silicon that have electrodes on each side. They're biased in a perpendicular direction, and they're separated by a little insulating barrier. And if you shine some light on this, then it creates some charge carriers, and so you get a current flowing from, basically from these electrodes here out of these electrodes. So let's say if you have a ray of light that shines right in the center, then if you sum up the currents at these two electrodes, it's equal to these two electrodes simply because, you know, you have conservation of charge, so the charge is not disappearing. So the amount of current here is going to be the same as that. But, and by symmetry, the fact that the spot is right in the center, then the current flowing from this one here, out here, and flowing from here, out to here, is going to be equal. But now if my ray of light is off center, well, so the sums still hold. The total current here is equal to the total current here just because I'm conserving charge. But the current here is going to be different than the current from here just because there's a different resistance that it's seeing. So that means, you know, you basically get a current response that depends on the position of this light beam onto your photodetector. And if you imagine, so delta X is going to correspond to the difference in these two currents, and you can normalize that by the sum of the currents, and delta Y corresponds to the difference between these two currents divided by the sum. So you have now a photodetector that's sensitive to the position of light onto it. And typically what you have is not just a spot of light, but a distribution of light. And then the problem is fairly simple. You just add up the sum of those points. And what you measure is where the centroid of this pattern of light is onto this photodetector. So these photodetectors are very fast. They're also very linear. So you basically get a response as a function of position of the centroid of this position of light that's very linear in voltage response. So you can tell very accurately the position of a bead using back focal plane interferometry using one of these photodetectors.
So,
yeah.
So for here, this position is on XY plane, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how about data?
How about Z? Okay. Let me go back to...
So that's the position of center.
Right. So if you look at this diagram, so in the XY plane, your pattern is basically moving up or down, or you say that's the centroid of this pattern is moving up or down. So you detect that very well with that photodetector, like I showed you. In the Z direction, all you're doing is actually expanding or contracting this cone of light that's going through. So how do you detect this? If you're collecting all of this light, then you wouldn't see any effect because, you know, the amount of light that goes through is still the same regardless of where this is along the optical axis. But if you have something like an aperture that you put around this, and you only measure the intensity of light that goes through that aperture, and as this thing expands or contracts, then you see more or less light. So that's a standard trick that people use to get Z information of your bead as well, just by clipping the light off. They can just measure the intensity of light that passes through that aperture. And your position-sensitive photodetector also measures the intensity of light, so you can get all three dimensions from a single measurement. Does that make sense? If you have an aperture? Yeah, the center is not going to change. It's not going to change. So you wouldn't get you get a bunch of voltages out of this because you can measure each one of these individually. So you not only measure, you can measure the difference between them and get delta X or delta Y. And if you can measure the sum, which tells you how intense the light is on there. So if you measure the sum, then you can get Z information from that.
So it is also a linear relationship.
Yeah, it's maybe less linear than X and Y, but it still is linear near the center. Okay, that's a good question. I should have. Okay, so in the next 20 minutes, let's talk about calibration. Okay, so we've built a trap. We're able to stretch objects. We're able to measure the deflection of the bead from the center of trap, so we can very accurately to about 0.1 angstrom. But now we need to convert these deflection voltages, so the voltages that come out of my photodetector, into actual positions and forces, which is what I'm really interested in. So first of all, let me define a few parameters. So delta V is the voltage change that comes on my photodetector. And there's a proportionality alpha, which is just the slope of this curve, that relates the actual deflection in physical distance, like nanometers, to this voltage. And the force is simply related to that by the trap stiffness. So near the center, we know that the trap is harmonic, or it's a linear trap. So the stiffness times delta X, or alpha times K, is related to the voltage change in the photodetector. So there's several approaches to calibrating. You can calibrate by moving your bead a known displacement. And so one example of that is to have a bead stuck on a glass surface, and moving this glass surface, you know, if you have the ability to move either your trap relative to this glass surface or moving the stage on which this glass surface is connected to, and you know precisely how much you're moving it, then you have a way of calibrating the response of the bead deflection versus distance that you moved. So that's one way of doing it. The other way to do it is to calibrate with a known force. So for example, what people do is they'll trap a bead and they'll flow water through, and that causes a viscous drag on the object that's just given by Stokes' law. So the force, the viscous force on it, is equal to the drag coefficient, which just depends on the viscosity of this medium and the size of the particle, times the velocity, so that the flow velocity. So if you know flow velocity, you know the viscosity of your medium, then you know how much force you've applied to it, and you can convert how much this thing is deflected by into an actual force. So those are two very standard techniques that people use, but not the most common one. Any questions on these two? Does that make sense? How you get? Yeah.
So actually, from the left picture, calibration was the known displacement. So mm-hmm. from the equation you show on prior slides, if you know the dirt x and you can measure dirt v, then you can find the alpha.
That's right.
Right, and this is how to calibrate the condition. So how to find
the force? Yeah, you actually, you're right. That calibration does not give you the force. It just gives you this alpha here. And same thing with this. This just tells you alpha times kappa, but it doesn't tell you each one individually. Okay, so the most common way of calibrating these objects is to actually use the fact that the bead is undergoing Brownian motion. So I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on this because I think most people are not familiar with these concepts. So your trap is in a harmonic potential, but it's sitting in a bath that has temperature or thermal energy, KT, and so it's undergoing Brownian fluctuations, basically being kicked around by solvent molecules moving it one way or another. And this is basically a simulation of what this would look like. It's really moving all over the place. And it turns out that you can use this as a way to calibrate your trap. And one way to do this, or the most efficient way of illustrating this, is to use what's called the Langevin equation. All this is Newton's, so this is a way of characterizing this Brownian motion. And it just entails, before we do that, I want to do a quick order of magnitude calculation so you see how much this thing actually fluctuates inside a trap. So people know the equipartition theorem. Everybody's familiar with it? Okay. Pa- Paul, you're noting. You're nodding, but I know you are.
Yeah, I know. That's what I just realized. I'm nodding. Wait a second. Is anybody else nodding?
No, actually. Who's not familiar with the equipartition theorem?
Nobody's going to raise
it. Okay. Who is familiar with the equipartition theorem? Okay. Okay, that's most people. All right, good. So you know that for each half kBT of thermal energy, that is equal to the average energy in your system. So here we have a bead in an optical trap. In an average sense is what I mean. So that's what these brackets mean. So that means that the variance in the position of the trap is equal to kBT over the trap stiffness. OK, do people know what kBT is in terms of units that we care about, piconewtons and nanometers? Was that four? Yeah. OK, people do know this. OK, so kBT. KB is 1.38 times 10 to the minus 23. Is that right? And then T at room temperature is 300. So you actually 4.14 times 10 to the minus 21 joules, which is 4 piconewton nanometers. Now, if I plug in some numbers for this, so 4.14 piconewton nanometers divided by, let's say, a trap stiffness, typical one is 0.1 piconewton per nanometer. So my variance is something like 40 nanometers squared, or the RMS of the X position is on the order of 6 nanometers. So this is an amazing number because it tells you that the solvent is actually shaking your bead enough inside your trap that it's moving about 6 nanometers. Total. You might wonder, how do you measure things like kinesin stepping, which is an 8 nanometer step if your bead is actually fluctuating by 6 nanometers? And hopefully I'll answer this with, I only have like 15 minutes to do so. Okay, so the way we characterize Brownian fluctuations is through an equation called the Langevin equation. Have they gone through this, Paul, or yeah. No? This is like Newton's equation with a slight modification. So I'm going to put in the force terms that correspond to the bead motion. One is that, you know, we're operating in a very viscous medium. This is the low Reynolds number. Have you described low Reynolds number? Okay. Basically, what it means is that
they will get to it.
Under these microscopic scales, you can ignore things like inertia. Really, everything is dominated by the viscosity of the medium, and so the most important force next to the trapping force is this thing moving in a viscous medium. So it goes as the drag coefficient of the bead times the velocity of the bead in the medium. Then this is the trapping force, so it's linear in the displacement, and it goes as the trap stiffness. And now I have one extra term, and this is what is special about the Langevin equation, is I have a force here that fluctuates as a function of time, and this is what models how the environment is moving this bead around and making it fluctuate. And I don't know this force really accurately. I can't tell you how this behaves as a function of time other than in an average statistical sense. I only know that the average force is zero. That all that means is that the solvent is an equal probability of pushing your bead forward than backwards, right? So it's basically averages to zero. But its variance is not equal to zero. And in fact, we're going to talk a little bit more about this quantity, which is related to the variance, but is a little different. This is called the autocorrelation function. So it's the average of the force at some time with itself at some time later. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about this because people are not so familiar with it. So what does this quantity mean? It's you're taking an average of a time trace that's fluctuating over time with itself at some time later. So here's a plot of this. So the red curve is actually, what I did is I made a random number generator in MATLAB, and I made this time trace. And now I have, why is this shaking so much? It's Brownian motion, I think. And now I have the same trace delayed by some time delta t. So this is the difference between t and t prime. And I'm taking the average of this quantity. So obviously, if these points are completely random, and what I mean by random is that each point is completely uncorrelated with the previous one. So it's as if I'm flipping a coin. Every time I flip a coin, the flip that I got previously doesn't matter at all. Every point is completely independent of the last point. If I take the average of this as a function of this delay here, I'm going to get, on average, zero. Okay, it's going to get a very small number. Even if I move in a little bit closer, just because there's no correlation between one point to the next. So on average, everything's going to cancel out. Does that make sense, first of all? Yeah, that part. But as I bring them closer, when they almost overlap, you can see that the average is going to deviate from zero. And in fact, as this time interval goes to zero, then you're going to get this average is going to be non-zero, because you're basically squaring the signal with itself. So if you actually look at this average as a function of this delta t, the difference between these two, it's essentially zero until these things are overlapping. And so you have basically a delta function response of this. By the way, this delta function response is exactly what's modeled for the autocorrelation of this Brownian force. So what we say is that every time point of the force is uncorrelated with the previous time point. So the autocorrelation function is a delta function. And the amplitude of this depends on kT. So this is where the thermal energy comes in to the model. OK, so now let's take a look at something that's slightly more interesting.
Why does it
depend on gamma? That's a very subtle question. So this is what comes out of the fluctuation dissipation theorem. Basically, why does the size of the bead actually matter? Even though
I've never understood that, but okay. I still don't.
I'm not sure I still understand it either, but that's what happens. Okay, so now we're going to look at a slightly more complicated time trace, where now each data point is slightly correlated with the ones in the past. And this is basically a truer model of what's going on over the trap and the bead. Because it's moving in a viscous medium, it kind of has memory of what it was doing in the past. So you can kind of see that there's an envelope here that has some kind of memory, right? It's like every point kind of has a memory of where it was before. If it's low here, it was low also previous to that. Now, if I do this average, you'll see that as delta t is large, then you're not going to get a very large value for this average. But as you move them in closer, see now like this big feature here is kind of being duplicated here, so you're going to get a larger number. And of course, as I almost overlap them, that number is going to grow even bigger. But so the upshot of that is that the autocorrelation function is not just a delta function, but it has an envelope in it. And it tells you about how correlated these time traces are, which tells you about the dynamics of this process. And specifically for a trap bead, this tail here is exponential. And it tells you about the dynamics of this Brownian motion. And in fact, the bead, because it's moving in a viscous medium, has memory of where it was before. It's always moving. You know, if I'm moving in this direction, it keeps moving in this direction and then back over a particular time scale, which is basically the width of this time. Okay, this is a long story to explain how we calibrate traps. But actually, this stuff is really useful in general, and it's a part of your education that you should have.
It is useful in that, shortly be getting to diffusion constants and things like that.
That's right.
So this will be useful.
This is a very good model for diffusion. Okay, so the solution to the Langevin equation for a trap bead, so here's our trap, and here's the viscous drag on the bead, and here's our fluctuating force, is an autocorrelation function that is exponential in the time delta t, so the time difference between these two times. And you'll notice one thing, which is really nice, that when t prime is equal to t, this goes to zero, and you get back what you got from equipartition. So you get back the variance that you had before. So in a way, you can think of this as a more general type of variance. It gives you information about dynamics, whereas just the variance just tells you about the equilibrium. Okay, but essentially the two reduce to each other. Now, another quantity of interest is called the Lorentz, is called the power spectrum, and this is simply the Fourier transform of this quantity here. And I'll leave it as an exercise to show that the Fourier transform of an exponential is something called a Lorentzian. So it's a function that goes, that I'll show you in the next slide, is flat at low frequencies and then rolls off as 1 over f squared at high frequencies. Almost done.
Usually I give them a couple minutes because they write a little evaluation.
Okay. Give me 5 minutes and I'll definitely be done. One thing I want to do is, so there's a decay time here in this exponential, which is basically how correlated this motion is over time. And I just want to do a quick calculation of this. So where am I? Right, so gamma, first of all, from Stokes' law, is equal to 3 pi times eta times d. This is the viscosity of the medium, and this is the diameter of your bead. If you plug in the numbers for this, 3 pi eta in terms of numbers, that units that we care about, is 10 to minus 10. Sorry, it's actually 10 to minus 9. Piconewton second over nanometer squared. And if we have, say, a micron bead, so 1,000 nanometers, then you get 10 to the minus 5 per nanometer, which means that gamma over kappa is a time. So this is 1 times 10 minus 5 over 0.1 piconewton per nanometer. This is 100 microseconds. I hope I did my algebra right. But so that tells you that a bead in a trap, its motion is correlated on these timescales of 100 microseconds. So if you look at this information in frequency space, you get this kind of behavior. And how do we use to actually calibrate our system? Well, so remember that what we measure is actually not a voltage, but a distance. And this has units of distance squared. So my conversion factor alpha, which is how I convert from position to voltage, comes in here squared. Let's say I took the voltage out of my photodetector, I put a bead in there, and I get this noise that comes out of it. This is what I get in terms of voltage. So at high frequencies, what you find is that you know all the parameters that you need to. So obviously you know what the frequency is. Pi is just a constant, kT is a constant. Gamma you know if you know the size of the bead. And so this allows you, in this regime, to determine what alpha is. So you can convert from voltage to position just by looking at this part of your signal. And at low frequencies, this behavior is flat. Now you know what alpha is, you know what gamma is, you know what kT is. And that allows you to determine what the stiffness of your trap is. So by doing a single measurement of a bead trapped in your optical trap, you're able to get two parameters basically for free, your alpha and your kappa, just by doing this very simple measurement. And so this is the standard method that people use to calibrate their optical trap. And really, all you're relying on is the fact that this problem is so well worked out and just depends on the thermal energy of the bath that you can essentially use this as a calibrated force source to calibrate your instrument. Okay, so next time, after break, we'll discuss applications of optical traps. And and we'll take a tour of my lab, too, so you guys can see what one of these things actually looks like. Okay, and I guess we're just out of time.
Why don't you spend a minute or two